clear as the query are on Boutros Ghali and the way they were dealing with your phones, if any.
Well, as you say, there was two totally different stages. And they each sort of had to take care of Pérez Cuellar did the negotiating part, and Boutros Ghali did the compliance part, or the implementation part. I thought that they both had the very positive attitude towards making a successful story out of El Salvador's process. So they were committed to the peace process in the country. I think that what happened was that for Pérez de Cuellar, I believe it was more of an important issue in a way, in a sense. He was leaving. He wanted this thing to be successful. He wanted to see it through. Whereas Boutros Ghali, though he always was very positive towards it, I'm pretty sure that it wasn't really that as high in his agenda as it was with Pérez de Cuellar, because he didn't start the thing. Mm. But, he got in there at the middle. I think that no matter whether there was two different secretary generals, basic representative kept on being the same one. So we sort of...
You mean De Soto?
Yes. He was sort of the link between one and the other.
I was going to ask you that, because actually Boutros Ghali sent Goulding a couple of times rather than De Soto.
Well, at the end, he realized that we would get much further on with Goulding than with De Soto.
And you did, you thought?
I think Goulding was a lot more clear-cut.
Even though he was not really familiar with the territory.
Well, I think he was. Let me tell you, there was a big issue with respect to the land program.
Yes, I know.
I think Goulding was able to handle an issue that was resolved that I think that De Soto would either have taken a lot longer or complicated things a lot more. I think that Merrick Goulding was, he sort of understood much better what the reality was.
Because he did develop the plan for the land transfer that eventually the Secretary General presented to you, and which both sides accepted, I think.
Yes.
Has that proved to be a sound plan? Is this,
yes. When you plan an agreement with, such an extensive agreement without starting the implementation of something, once you start implementing things, you have to change a few things here and there. But I think it went on without having the agreement in itself being the problem. It's the implementation and our laws and other things that made it, last so long in implementing. So I think it was a good agreement that was reached. Now that I see backwards, now the FMLN is wanting that land for free. They don't want to pay for it anymore. And the government hasn't said, now it's time to come. You have to comply with the peace agreement. You have to pay for it, because the agreement was that it was the buying of land, not the giving away.
While we're still on the subject of UN personalities, in Copaz, the representative of the UN was Blanca Antonini. What were the feelings here about the UN participation in Copaz?
I think it was Coca-Cola para. Since I wasn't involved in Copaz.
Yeah, yeah.
And after seeing that everybody sort of, you know, liked her.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was able to work with a very heterogeneous group there in Copan. And she was now, there's a bill in Congress, I don't know whether it passed or not yet, but there was a bill in Congress in trying to honor her for her role in Copan.
Oh, really?
Yes.
She's working on UN reform at the moment, in case you're interested.
Maybe she'll do as well as that as she did with Elsa.
As you know, Blanca was with De Soto throughout the entire negotiating process. I always thought more as a note taker.
She was.
Trying to keep up with what Shafiq Handal and Oscar Santa Maria would say during the meetings.
Incidentally, going back just for a minute, I have to ask you a kind of indiscreet question. De Soto, certainly, and Perez de Cuellar got the impression from him, but this is partly an explanation about De Soto's perhaps partiality toward the FMLN. An impression that you followed the technique of sending a delegation of hardliners, people who in fact had very little leeway to make any concessions at all. And to hold up until you yourself could become involved and take a reasonable position. What do you say to that?
I think it's totally incorrect. Hardliners, I'm sure that if you talk to Oscar Santa Maria, David Escobar Galindo, even Vargas,
mm-hmm.
If you compare Army hardliners versus Army moderates, I would say it was more of a moderate group than the hardliners.
Mm-hmm.
I could have sent hardliners.
Well, I have to say we did interview Galinda, and definitely he comes across certainly as a moderate and not as a hardliner. So I'm just telling you, that is the, I wanted to get what I expected your reaction would be, but because that was what was being reported to a certain extent.
Well, not being personally involved or directly involved with the FMLN, it was a matter of in a way, you know, saying, I'm going to send a team you can work with, but I never agreed in Duarte meeting people that were outside of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They were outside of the law by every means.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to bring in within the law.
I'd like to go on now to what is this large area really of democratization, in which there were various aspects. You had the Truth Commission, and the whole human rights operation on the part of UNASAL, and I believe there was a special person then designated by the United Nations to work with the government as an expert on human rights. UNASAL also then played a rather important role in monitoring the elections in 94 and in making some pretty direct suggestions as to how it should happen. In other words, coming fairly close to direct intervention in the domestic affairs of El Salvador. I wanted to get your reaction to all of this. I mean, what was the ultimate effect in terms of the prospects of democracy in El Salvador of these actions taken by the United Nations, by UNASAL in particular?
Well, I think you mentioned two distinct areas.
The
Truth Committee for one, and the Human Rights Group. I think think that everybody wanted to work in a way where human rights in El Salvador was something sacred that everybody should. And because of what had happened in the country for decades, from both sides, I think it was very helpful to have a sort of a, not an arbitrator, but somebody that could be seen as objectively coming in and saying, "This, you're doing this wrong, or you're going about it the wrong way," etc. Because human rights here have been politicized somewhat. The left always used it to accuse the government of being a human rights violator. I was in the opposition with respect to President Duarte, but I'm pretty sure that he never ordered anybody shot or his rights violated. That's not to say that human rights violations didn't go on in the country while he was president, but he didn't condone them or he didn't want them to happen. And it wasn't a government policy to break human rights. Neither was ours. But since the issue of human rights has been used for purposes, political purposes, I think that the role of the UN here was very important to overcome all this huge politicized issue that had gone by for so many years. So I think that that was very helpful to have that group here.
And I think it did it well. And you think it that the onus of how did that part of its job well?
Yes. Well, we had some very difficult issues to deal with. As you remember, there was three or four FMLN persons that were assassinated very, very nearly, very, very close after the agreements were signed. And the first reaction of the FMLN is that the government was annihilating the opposition. And I think that the ONUSAL being here and saying, "Well, wait a minute, you know, it could be true, but you have to investigate further to see if it is true before you start blaming each other." And in a way, to sort of stop these, you know, impulsive reactions every time something happened that everybody was a human rights violator in the country. And that allowed for things like investigations to go on. And in some cases say, "Well, yeah, you know, this guy committed a crime for such..." In other cases saying, "This had nothing to do with politics. It was, you know, this guy ran into some other guy's car, and everybody here is trigger happy in the country, and they got into a quarrel and they shot him." It had nothing to do with politics. So I think there was very, very helpful. I think without a team like that here, those issues could have been highly explosive for the starting of the reconciliation process and the strengthening of democracy, which was really the end objective of the whole effort. So I think that was very helpful. I'm afraid I can't say, I cannot be as... as positive as that with the Truth Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some ways having people from out of the country, which was obviously necessary for a Truth Committee to come about. Nobody would have believed Salvadorians going about telling the world. But maybe the task that this group had to do maybe was going a little bit too much further of what we should have had. For instance, if the objective of the peace process was to have the FMLN participate in the democratic process without weapons, obviously these people wanted to be diputados or presidents of the country. For the Truth Committee to have as a punishment the non-participation for a 10-year period of these people is, I mean, it's really not understanding what things were all about. And the inevitable came about. The FMLN and the government got together and say, this is nonsense what these guys have said. And we went up to the UN. We didn't go up to New York, but we told the representative here, saying, listen, this is our agreement. We both now agree not to comply with this recommendation, and we're not going to. Mm-hmm. And since it is our agreement, we can agree to disagree. And that's what finally happened. Because although explicitly only the names of the top group of one of the groups was put in, with name and surname, it was obvious that all the five teams were involved in human rights violations. How are you going to, say to the FMLN leadership, for 10 years you're out of politics? It was simply
in broader terms, leaving out the UN role, but this question of a truth commission or a truth committee, do you feel that it is essential to have this type of investigation and ultimately publication in order to provide a basis for the reintegration of society within a democratic government?
I don't see it as an imperative.
You do not?
I think we would have moved forward as much as we have with or without that report. As a matter of fact, that report had, in the public image, very little bearing. I think that some of the recommendations they made with respect to the judicial reform, some were very good, some not so good, but in all, their proposals, I think, were going towards strengthening the independence and the strengthening of our judicial system. But with respect to sort of investigating past crimes and telling people that, this happened or this didn't happen, I'm not sure that that is so necessary, or at least would have been necessary for our case. Maybe I'm going too far saying that it would not be helpful in some other place. But I think here that really made a difference, that it was like it was probably like a bestseller. It's in the news for a month, then everybody, then a new bestseller comes out, and everybody starts reading the new bestseller. And publicly speaking, that's what really happened to that report. Nobody
really
even remembers that.
When Boutros Ghali gave his report on it.
Nobody talks about it.
Well, it's interesting, because what he said, and this is relevant, obviously, to what's happening in South Africa and many other places, but he said that now that the truth has been brought to light, the people of El Salvador can contemplate forgiveness. You don't think that was...
What I'm trying to say is that with respect to investigations, I'm not sure that we didn't know what the Truth Committee came up with. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether because we're a very small country and everybody knows everybody here, and everybody's, he's my compadre, he's my comadre, and everybody knows what goes on in El Salvador. It's very difficult to hide things here. Mm-hmm.
The truth was known, in other words.
that aspect, I'm not sure that it was that helpful. Mm-hmm. Even before the Truth Committee came up with their report, I'm pretty sure that the Salvadorian society was ready to forgive. They might have not been ready to forget, by thing to forgive. And if they were willing to forgive, it's everybody, not this group or that group or whatever. Let's forgive everything and let's start a new era in the country.
And that has happened. What about the Onasal work with the police, the transformation of the police?
Well, not only Onasal. I must say that in this respect, I think it has been the support of quite a bit of a lot of countries. Obviously, yeah. The UN was very helpful in getting countries to cooperate. And PNSA has received a lot of support from a whole bunch of countries.
USAID, I think, for example, gave money.
U.S. is, that's their only project here. But people like Spain, Chile, we had Mexico support at the beginning, Europeans, the French, got some Italian, some British. I think the best help that the UN made in that respect is to get all these countries to work together in a coordinated fashion towards setting up, on the one hand, the academy, and on the other hand, the police itself. Mm-hmm. Not been easy to start from scratch and build a new security force for a country. It was very complicated.
But this was one of those cases, in fact it was the first case, where the UN sent a whole police battalion, so to speak, of civilian police to work with a country.
Obviously some countries decided to come down independently, yeah. And others decided, okay, we'll put on the UN's uniform and work with that uniform. But obviously it's the different police forces of these countries that brought their know-how into how to help our national police. But in a way, if we did not have the UN, we would not have all these, the variety of support and you know, each police has its good things and its bad things, and in here I think we were able to bring in a lot of experiences and what the good things were and try to put them together. And a lot of manpower was necessary for teachers. Who were we going to use locally to teach courses in the new police academy?
As you say, there were many countries and many institutions involved in this. I wanted to ask you specifically about the UN organizations that were active here, including the World Bank. How did you feel that they worked together, or did they work together at all? I mean, how was the coordination? How was the total effect of all of the different UN organizations that were here?
Well, we really don't see the World Bank as involved in the peace process itself. Mm-hmm. We have been working since 1989 with the World Bank and trying to reach a standby agreement with them, somewhat of a different area. Mm-hmm. I think indirectly, though, World Bank, UNDP, the UN in general, were very helpful in gathering countries to help financially to have these agreements complied with. Mm-hmm. The amounts of money that, especially at the beginning, the UN was able to get for the compliance of the agreements was obviously very, very important. Mm-hmm. We probably could not have made it without all that financial aid coming into the country. Somewhat in the area of $800 million came in.
Right. Apart from the World Bank.
The World Bank didn't put a cent.
A separate one, but...
You've had the effort.
On the other hand, the UN itself, particularly in the person of Alvaro de Soto, was quite critical of the lack of coordination between what the World Bank was doing here and what the UNDP was doing, particularly in agricultural policy. Did you notice any such problem? That's encouraging, I'm glad to hear that.
I don't think the World Bank had to do anything. Never heard of the World Bank coming in and trying to do something with respect to agricultural policy in the country.
Well, there was some conditionality, I think, in the terms of the funds that they provided.
But I don't think in our 5 years we never made use of 1 cent of the standby loan of the World Bank. Mm-hmm. It was just simply a way of getting recognition that macroeconomically speaking, we're doing things the right way and that we would therefore be seen as a good recipient of international loans. From other sources. But
right.
We never used 1 cent of the World Bank's loan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know if that has continued that way, but at least...
No, the period I was talking about was, in fact, the earlier period when I think UNDP was helping to finance some of the land transfer
program. Yeah, the UNDP did.
And apparently, I actually don't know, but DeSoto wrote a whole article about it that appeared in.
But as a matter of fact, just to be fair, both with the World Bank and the IMF.
Yeah.
We received a lot of, I would say, not recognition, but in a way, understanding that in 92, the peace process was more important than macroeconomic policy. And that even though we had negotiated a certain, let's say, target for an inflation rate and government spending and deficit, etc., after we started to sort of using the cash register, what are we going to need to comply with all of this? We went up to both of them and said, listen, we're going to have to accept that we're not going to comply with this and because this is more important. This is more of a priority for the government. And we never were rejected by neither the IMF or the World Bank.
You found understanding then.
And if you see our inflation rate from 89 to 91 coming down, and you see the 92 going up, And we never had a problem with either of the two institutions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's because they understood that there was something more important for that particular year mm-hmm. than macroeconomic policy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what de Soto meant.
I'm glad to hear your comments on that. I'm just going to ask one more question, and this is a very specific question. I don't know whether you're familiar with it or not, but El Salvador has achieved one thing I think no other country has achieved that's had an internal struggle. You've more or less solved the problem of landmines. Again, UNICEF, I believe, helped with that to a certain extent from the UN family. How did you do this? How did you go about the approach to landmines?
Well, we sort of put out a bid for experts in demining zones, or in this case, a country, although our country would look like a zone in any other country.
Mm-hmm.
And when we finally chose one, the problem was getting the funds for it, which we didn't have at that time. we talked to the FMLN and the armed forces and said, if you guys help, we will just go ahead with it. We'll see how we pay it later. And we told UNICEF, we're going to do this, but you will going to have to go around the world with your agencies trying to look for the monies to pay for it. Both the FMLN and the armed forces, it was their first task working together after the peace agreement with this Belgian company. And I think that probably the doing it as early as possible made it possible for everybody to remember where they had mined. If you would allow